The following is a rebroadcast of Studio Tulsa. This program first aired last year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Gender roles in food go back, well, just about as far as humans themselves. Think of the ways we produce food for consumption. Grilling or smoking meats, we generally think of men doing that. Baking, women. Even foods themselves have a connotation of a gender attached to them. Diet sodas or yogurt, women. A triple-decker burger, men. In fact, when a food becomes closely associated with one gender, the other shies away. A trait known as gender contamination. Even brands within a single food type can experience this. My guest, a University of Tulsa professor and media critic, has written about food culture and how gender and power issues are wrapped into the foods we eat. Her new book, Diners, Dudes, and Diets, explores the world of dude food, you know, spicy, hot foods, loaded burgers and barbecue and the like, and how advertisers will try to entice dudes to try those gender-contaminated foods by appealing to their dudeness, I suppose. Emily Contois is the Chapman Assistant Professor of Media Studies at the University of Tulsa. Her work on food culture has been featured in the Wall Street Journal, the Huffington Post, and Salon, and she's the book reviews editor for Food, Culture, and Society. Emily Contois, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich. Glad to be here.
Yeah, gender issues surrounding food have always been with us, but certainly they've been complicated by our media culture, which is a big part of your book. You begin, though, by telling a story of Thanksgiving in your family, which I found so incredibly sad and very informative about your subject. Would you tell us that story and what that story explains?
Definitely. So Thanksgiving in my family, my mom and my grandmother would cook all these amazing dishes. But then when we would sit down, my grandmother never ate that meal with us. She ate a lean cuisine meal instead. She was an exceedingly thin woman who lived with an eating disorder for a lot of her life. And so growing up, seeing that eating experience on a day that is about community and eating a lot and eating food that has deep meaning really cemented for me the idea that food can be both anxious and full of this deep meaning, that there's deep complexity. I'm not the first scholar to say that, you know, the United States maybe has a national eating disorder and that there's this anxiousness that we bring to our experience with food. So I've always been interested in exploring those contradictions, those complexities. And so then to bring gender into it, it gives you a lot of room to play and to think.
That is a story about gender, because I can't think of any man that would do that. You know, work on a meal all day and then pull out a TV dinner, you know, or something like that. You know, that just wouldn't happen.
No, that there are these unreasonable expectations put upon women's bodies, right, of what we look like, of how slim we're supposed to be. But what I actually found interesting researching the book was finding that some of those norms and those feelings of anxiety are becoming even more commonplace for men as well. And men across the life course, not just men in college or in high school, but men all throughout their lives, being similarly dissatisfied with their bodies as they look at the ideals, the celebrities, the sports stars that are held up. And so I wrote a book about men and masculinity also as a way to be able to understand women and femininity, to be able to understand gender and power in relationship to one another. Too often what we see are these binary representations. And so looking at them both is where you can see this more complete story.
As you write in the book, it says, you know, there is this anxiousness about meeting this male ideal as well. Six-pack abs, you know, looking good. But then there's the dad bods, too, which are equally acceptable and in some ways celebrated.
Exactly. There's this flexibility for men that I argue the dude, right, is this figure that I'm looking at in the book. That there is that flexibility for men. But where is the mom bod, Rich, right? From when you actually, right, make babies. That's part of the argument I make about how the dude makes some things a little bit more flexible for some men, but it still upholds, like, the overall structure of power, right? It's not really dismantling how we think about bodies or how we think about ideals so that everybody has that flexibility. So the dad bod was so much fun to research, but the question is, where is mom bod in that?
Right. Give us an idea of how dad bods are celebrated.
Yes, so it actually came out of college writing. It was a university student who gave us the word dad bod, of a dad bod that still works out. It is still a physically fit body, but it's one that eats a whole pizza, right? Or drinks multiple beers at a time, right? It's a body that isn't lean, that doesn't look like the ones that you would see on the cover of, you know, fitness magazines, but it's still this like productive, healthy body. But we often see it on celebrities, right? Gossip magazines love to publish photos of dad bods. And so there's a level of sort of this body positivity to it that I think is wonderful. But as we think about it in that larger scenario of what it tells us about bodies in power, we want to see it push further.
You first pursued this subject when I think you wrote an article about one, I have to say, I've seen it once, and I would say it is the dumbest food television shows ever created. It was one called Hot Ones, and it was about a host and a guest who would basically sit in tables across from one another and eat increasingly hot chicken wings. And it is one of the stupidest programs ever made. But tell me about the reaction to the article when you wrote about this.
Yes, I was watching the show as I was writing my dissertation with my husband, and it was a fun show. Like, it does have this dumb premise, but like, we were enjoying it. But it's hard to not look at it and see that there's this competition with spiciness, right? That you eat food that hurts, that there is sort of this masculine element sort of embedded in that. But what I was interested in is how the male and female guests on the show had to perform their celebrity differently. So the magic of that show is actually this idea that as you're eating these increasingly spicy wings, that it sort of peels back the facade of celebrity, right? We get to see who this person really is. Will they tell us what they really think, you know, when they're sweating and gulping milk and, you know, they're in all this pain? But that's part of what makes the show so interesting to watch. But I argued that men and women have to kind of play that dance differently. There are different rewards and different risks to this spicy bar food in public. And that for men, there were these greater risks if you lost, right? If you could only eat, you know, three chicken wings and then you have to tap out, oh, I can't do this, right? You get made fun of for that. And then for women to play along, right, they're given expectations for how women are supposed to eat and look and conduct themselves, that too, you know, have snot running down your face and, you know, to be swearing. And that simply plays out differently. And so I argue that if you're a woman, you have to play this sort of cool girl persona where you have sort of these dudish traits, but you're still expected to be this conventionally beautiful woman. And that's not a role that every woman or every celebrity woman can play. So I was just interested in looking at those differences. But, you know, Breitbart wrote about it. A number of sort of conservative publications picked it up and were really critical of this idea that food has a gender. And so if you haven't learned that idea, right, that gender comes to us through our culture, right? Masculinity and femininity only mean what we make them to mean, and that that meaning can change over time. And so things like particular foods or how we eat or how we conduct our bodies, these are spaces in which our everyday lives that those ideas about gender take root. So it only furthered, you know, my interest in these stories and to continue with writing the book.
This idea that gender doesn't exist in food, it just seems so counterintuitive, because when you look at all the marketing of food, it is all marketed towards gender. Certain foods, you know, grilling, that is a masculine trait. Other foods, you know, all of these things are ingrained in food.
Yes. So two of the foods that I look at specifically in the book are yogurt, which had been considered kind of a feminine food. And until the decades I'm looking at in the 2000s and the 2010s, hadn't really been marketed to men. It had really been considered this food for women. So looking at how marketers went about changing the branding, changing the packaging, what kind of messaging did they have in the marketing? And, you know, seeing all throughout media and pop culture how these ideas about foods being gendered. So I definitely looked at yogurt specifically and then diet sodas, looking at Coke Zero and Dr. Pepper 10 when they both launched and tried to go after men, right, with this non-diet diet soda.
I noticed just in the last day or so you wrote an obituary for Tab Cola, which was, I guess, made by Coca-Cola. I'm surprised Tabs was still even existed in 2020. And this was a soda that was completely marketed to women.
Yeah, so TAB is Coca-Cola's very first diet soda. It comes out in 1963 to compete with sodas like Diet Right, which had been out for a couple of years, and they were doing so well. Diet sodas were first made for diabetics and folks who needed to be able to manage their sugar intake. But they were so successful when they first came out that all the big brands sort of rushed to develop their own. And so I'd only ever seen TAB in its like bright pink can, which was, you know, redesigned once we have it in cans. But when it first comes out, it's in this beautiful glass bottle that has like sparkles on it, that has this sort of touch of femininity. But it was also this huge revolution in sort of bottle design to have this ribbed exterior. It's really fascinating as a piece of history, all of the story with TAB. But you're absolutely right. In recent years, it has been 1% of Coca-Cola sales. From a business perspective, it certainly made sense that they wouldn't keep making it. But it has continued to have this deep niche following, mostly of college-educated women, but it also had this sort of retro chic nostalgia quality for a growing number of younger drinkers as well.
Yeah. One of the things you're talking about diet soda and yogurt to an extent is that most of these products appeal to one gender or another, but in the case of diet soda, it appeals mainly to women. But the makers have always wanted a male market for that.
Yeah, so I actually make that argument about everything I'm looking at in the book. So I analyze cookbooks, food television through the figure of Guy Fieri, diet sodas, yogurts, and commercial weight loss programs like Weight Watchers. And so in every case, those industries, those companies have wanted men as well, right, to be able to increase their market share and to have more consumers. And so in the book, what I'm looking at is how these industries attempted to market to men what were perceived to be something that was feminine. And so marketing scholars call that gender contamination, the idea that men don't want to buy something that they think is feminized. So I was so fascinated in each of those product categories to see how they attempted to speak to men about masculinity, to be able to convince them that buying a cookbook or watching food TV or drinking diet soda or going on a diet was something that was okay for a man to do.
Now, when I think of watching food TV, I would think a lot of the programs are really set up for male audiences. I mean, you get into the whole idea of dude food, which is sort of what this book is about. And dude food is very prevalent on food television.
Definitely. So I define dude food as comfort food with an edge of competitive destruction, which goes back a little bit to this idea of hot ones, right? We think of something like spiciness. Another example I love to show when I do, you know, the visual version of the talk with the book, it's called The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse Burger. Burgers Priest in Ontario makes it. And it's multiple burger patties, it is multiple fried onion rings, and then instead of buns, it's grilled cheese sandwiches. So it's this exaggerated, extra, extra version of food that we might consider sort of comforting or classic. And so they're usually, you know, quite high in fat and carbs, so they make us feel good on a level. But at a certain point, it's so exaggerated, the portion sizes are so large, that eating them, right, would actually make you feel ill if you can even figure out how to get it in your mouth. And so dude food has been so fascinating to see it on a variety of menus, to see it circulate in a lot of ways, and to see how it connotes these ideas about not just gender, and particularly masculinity, but also about social class, of dude food pushing back against the sort of perceived elitism of fine dining. It's very often, you know, very simply plated and presented when you eat it at the table. The dishes also, right, they're usually just like heavy white crockery when we look at how restaurants serve this food. But it connotes these ideas, particularly of gender and class, in a number of ways. But to your point about Food Network, definitely we've seen this shift from educational content about how to cook to things like cooking as competition, and figures like Guy Fieri. So I write a tiny bit about Emeril Lagasse and how he kind of paves the way for Guy Fieri to be this dude chef. And so in the book, I'm less interested in Guy Fieri himself than in how people either very, very much love him or they hate him. That deeply polarizing potential was so much fun to unpack.
My guest today is Emily Contois. She's the Chapman Assistant Professor of Media Studies at the University of Tulsa And she has a new book out titled Diners, Dudes, and Diets, How Gender and Power Collide in Food, Media, and Culture. Well, let's talk about Guy Fieri. You spent a whole chapter exemplifying how he exemplifies dude culture in food. And he is this larger in life. You know, it doesn't matter if he's hosting a cooking show or a competition show or his restaurant series. It's all about home cooking, but knocked up several notches, flavor. I mean, everything is about it is about appealing to this dude culture.
Absolutely. So from the food that he cooks and promotes, you see that dude food element. And then his persona as this dude chef that pushes back against expectations of masculinity in so many ways, whether it's the fact that he wears shorts everywhere or, you know, his bleached spiked hair, that he's always been pushing back against that level of decorum, right? The expectation of what a professional chef and a food celebrity, right, is supposed to look like and act like. I write about Guy Fieri cuisine, and maybe my favorite component of that is this idea of a culinary set of manners. And, you know, unlike saying, you know, my compliments to the chef, I love how Guy Fieri, right, will say, you know, like, put that on a flip-flop, right? Like, he'll say all these crazy things.
And give him a fist bump.
Yes, exactly. That fist sandwich of all this, the knuckle sandwich, rather, of, you know, all this exuberant energy around food that kind of pushes out of bounds of what's expected of a culinary figure. But what I found interesting is going back and studying his persona from 2006 when he is a contestant on the second season of Next Food Network Star. He is who he is from his audition tape. Compared to other celebrities, you know, and pop stars who are reinventing themselves all the time, he is so remarkably consistent and himself. And so the piece of that story that I love is when we get to 2011 and 2012 with Pete Wells writing this, you know, horrendous review about Guy's kitchen and bar in Times Square in New York City, that it is the first time the New York Times gives a 0-star-4 review. And he writes this review, you know, wholly in questions, and it absolutely attempts to eviscerate Fieri. But in the aftermath of that, instead of him being ruined by the food establishment, he's fully recuperated as this just good dude, right? Like, how dare we go after this guy who just loves to make this food and is just this good dude? So I've been so fascinated to see the rise, fall, and rise of Guy Fieri, that the dude has significant staying power within him.
I'm wondering if you see connections between our political viewpoints and how, you know, you see the establishment of the food world, and in this case, the New York Times food section. It's like the ultimate sort of authority figure, and it rejects him utterly. And yet people just say because of that rejection, it makes him more appealing.
Exactly. He had significant sort of populist resonance. For viewers, they say things like, you know, everyone else is talking down to you. But Guy Fieri doesn't, right? He's not trying to change your diet. He's not trying to convince you of something. He is happily and enthusiastically creating content that lots of viewers want to watch. And so I found in that something really powerful to consider with the populist rise of Donald Trump, which can also happen on the left as well, right, with Bernie Sanders, of seeing that populist message resonate deeply in this divided moment. And so there was. I could have written a whole book just about Guy Fieri. So I did have an article that I spun off that was exactly about this question of the kind of America that Guy Fieri creates on Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives, and what his specific brand of populism has to do with why that resonates so deeply.
That's probably his most popular show, at least from the amount of time it is actually on cable television. And what does it exemplify?
I love how it's showing food all across America. I think he's been to almost every state at this point. And so folks often talk, right, about hot food cities and, you know, the coasts being these hotbeds for, you know, great food and innovative cuisine. But he has this, you know, really democratic and inclusive recognition that great food happens everywhere. In my food media class at TU, I have the students read the Bon Appetit review of Nonesuch in Oklahoma City. You know, a couple of years ago, they recognized it, right, as the best new restaurant in America. And I've eaten there, and I agree, it's wonderful. But the way that review is written, like, I think the title is something about, you know, how did two chefs who no one's ever heard of in a city that no one ever visits come up with this great restaurant, right? It's with this, like, questionable derision that they're also celebrating the cuisine and the flavors and the taste of Oklahoma. And so I find in, you know, Guy Fieri and his drive-ins and dives, right, he would never say something like that, that other bastions of the food media community have certainly been guilty of. And as someone who grew up in Montana and now lives in Oklahoma, I take that discourse seriously of how we talk about there being great food all over this country and all around the world.
One interesting thing about Guy Fieri, and we'll move on in a moment, but it's very interesting. I always thought he came from the commercial food industry. And because of that sort of bro attitude, the dude attitude, because commercial, when you talk about masculinity, most commercial food kitchens, it's a place often of toxic masculinity within the kitchen itself.
Very true that the kitchen space, you know, all the way back from, you know, the French origins of the brigade system that's very militaristic and how it organizes power and how you move up and how you're treated within that space. There's still much work to do to make kitchens truly inclusive spaces for women, for people of color, for queer folks, to really be able to make their space in the world of food. So Guy Fieri, he has a degree in hospitality from the University of Nevada at Las Vegas, I believe, and then opened his own restaurant. So he didn't come up either through culinary school or through, you know, earning your stripes, right, of being in that brigade system, of actually working in a kitchen like that. And so that is one of the reasons that other chefs, right, sort of critique his expertise. He didn't go through either one of those paths. But it was interesting to go back and, you know, really closely, right? I did this full discourse analysis on that Next Food Network star. I'd seen all those episodes so many times to do this research. The judges, like, they do credit him, right, for his culinary skill, for how he creates dishes. That was never questioned as a part of that particular program. But it has been, right, in other spaces. In part, I argue, because he's pushing against this image of what the celebrity chef should look like, act like, and feel like.
My guest today is Emily Contois. She's the Chapman Assistant Professor of Media Studies here at the University of Tulsa. She has a new book out titled Diners, Dudes, and Diets. She's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, let's talk a little bit about cookbooks and the dieting industry, which certainly both of those at one point were always catered towards females, and now that has utterly changed.
Very true. So we were female dominated. And so I start my study around the year 2000. You start seeing some big changes then. But the other important piece of the context is the Great Recession and how that dramatically changes some men's opportunities in their careers. And so we find more men under or unemployed and at home, and maybe taking on some more of that domestic labor for the first time and negotiating their masculinity along with it. So we have seen a corpus of cookbooks since 2000, you know, trying to get men to cook more at home. And sometimes we see, you know, such a horrendous conventional sort of metaphor, right? So many of them talk about, you know, cavemen invented fire and man has always been cooking, right? You don't have to, you know, worry about being in the kitchen. It's not a feminine thing. I also loved how a couple of them have these cover designs. You know, one had this leather apron, you know, looks like you should be, you know, working in a garage or on a farm, butchering things, you know, like out in the field. Or another one, you know, you have a tool belt around your waist, right, full of all the kitchen implements. So looking at how these other metaphors of particularly working class masculinity were kind of marshaled to masculinize men cooking at home. And even if you look at the table of contents, they're organized very differently when they're being marketed to men. You know, with strange things like, you know, food for, you know, trying to get out of the doghouse with your girlfriend or your wife, food for after the gym, food for with your bros. I also looked at Men's Health did one of the first of these. It's called A Man, A Can, A Plan. And it's all these very, very simple recipes that, you know, are mostly out of cans. And it has an entire section for SpaghettiOs. Which isn't particularly manly, but maps onto this work I'm doing with dudes, right? That it resists sort of adult demands, and it's about being playful and just doing what you want. And so in that way, like, SpaghettiOs, right, is dude food in a man cookbook.
you know, you also have like a picture of one, I think it's one cookbook where it's like, you know, hey, you succeed at this recipe, you're going to be successful later in the evening as well, which sort of sends a kind of creepy message, if you will.
Absolutely. So that language of using food as a man, right, of cooking to seduce women, like that's around Esquire actually publishes their first cookbook for men in the 50s. And then they had another one in this time period that I'm looking at as well. And so this idea that you can impress women, right, by cooking her dinner and, right, to be able to make sure you can cook breakfast the next day. And so the picture you're referring to, right, when you think of typical cookbooks of, you know, beautiful plated dishes or maybe pictures of the kitchen or pictures of the chef, right, this is a semi-nude woman being embraced in bed. Those are the kinds of images that you'll see in a cookbook being marketed to men. And I think we can all see why that isn't something we want to promote more of.
Right. And I think your final section looks at how things like Weight Watchers and dieting organizations have really reached out to try to reach men. And it's very interesting that, you know, this is probably one that still men are resistant to that message, I think.
Yeah. So I was so interested in how Weight Watchers, for example, would market to men with the tagline, right, that real men don't diet, right, leaning into the stereotype even as they tried to market themselves. They also, you know, will market it with totally different food, right? Dude food is always what you're seeing, right? You're going to be eating burgers and wings and tacos. You're not going to count calories. You're not going to count points. You're just going to kind of track what you eat, and the weight's just going to fall off. But there is this total distance from the psychological work of weight loss, you know, that constant surveillance that so many women feel like they're under, to be watching what they eat all the time, that as they marketed to men, they made sure that that message was nowhere there. And I love your point about, you know, this being the hardest space, right, to sort of crack through these gender norms. That's why it's the last sort of example in the book. And so I spoke to a number of men who'd gone on Weight Watchers and become sort of, you know, influencers for men going on diets and being able to. And so a part of me thinks, right, like dieting is something, you know, none of us should do, right? We should just, you know, like my grandmother, right, work on our relationship with food, find joy in it, find balance, and that should be the end of it. But at the same time, a patriarchal system creates these limits that tells men that they can't care about their bodies and go on a diet and watch what they eat and try to eat more vegetables because of this idea that masculinity is about risk-taking and that you're not supposed to be sort of careful and comfortable. And so in talking to these men, they definitely experienced that resistance from themselves, from those around them, to be able to be a part of Weight Watchers when it was something that they felt was right for them and that they wanted to do. And so thinking about this space for men to be able to do whatever they want with their bodies. That one of the things I teach my students too, right, is that patriarchy oppresses all of us, not all of us equally, but like it's also not good for men. And the Weight Watchers chapter, the weight loss chapter, really showed that.
The name of the book is Diners, Dudes, and Diets. Emily, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Emily Contois is the Chapman Assistant Professor of Media Studies at the University of Tulsa and the author of a new book, Diners, Dudes, and Diets, How Gender and Power Collide in Food, Media, and Culture. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.